Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opianga Line, a podcast about the unique heritage and local culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opianga River Valleys. Some time ago, you heard a show here based on four personal essays about what it felt like to grow up in Barry's Bay more than 50 years ago. It was called The Boys of Summer, and it's still available wherever you found this podcast. It was a show that largely dealt with certain memorable local events, the death of a friend, an accidental shooting, the Acorn Wars, graduation night at MVDHS, all real events in the life of our producer Barry Conway, who grew up here in Barry's Bay in the 1950s, 60s, and early 1970s. Many of you told us you enjoyed reminiscing about some of those events that you had almost forgotten, memories about what went on here in the streets of this little global village back in the day. Well, today we have more memoirs, again written by the producer of the Opianga Line. Only this time, our show is called The Boys of Autumn. As before, we hope these essays will help transport you back to the 1960s, to those glory days of autumn when the village of Barry's Bay and surrounding area took on a very different flavor and color than those dog days of summer. Indeed, one essay deals with playing a pickup football game on a vacant lot on English Street, another with hunting partridge on Macaulay Road, and still another with a very peculiar tradition that we're still not certain was quite legal. Scoop fishing in late October on the Big Eddy. As you will soon discover, The Boys of Autumn has little in common with that wild abandon we heard about in The Boys of Summer, when back in the 1960s our wayward Barry was let out of school in late June and pretty much did what he damn well pleased all summer long without much in the way of adult supervision. The Boys of Autumn is a very different kettle of fish. Mercifully, those boys were back in school and bearing the full burden of a much more regulated life, closely supervised by attentive nuns, all with a shrewd eye and a handy strap. And yet, our Barry's Bay boys still managed to find time back in the day to engage in all manner of mischief, especially during weekends and evenings. Only unlike those halcyon days of summer, the boys of autumn often found themselves supposedly supervised by adults, though sometimes, we have to admit, not the most attentive adults, nor ones who lived by the letter of the law. Still, you be the judge. Here is the first of those essays that make up our show today, The Boys of Autumn, written and read by Barry Conway. It's called On Macaulay Lake Road.
Some people have asked me why I moved back to the Madawaska Valley. How could I give up that seeming Shangri-La of California with its lush scenery, brilliant Pacific sunsets, and warm, soothing climate? The short answer? I just couldn't live with its awful droughts, wildfires, and earthquakes. The long answer is a bit more complex. It had something to do with old ghosts along the Opianga I once encountered more than 50 years ago. Sometime around Thanksgiving 2015, I was suddenly reminded of a hunt camp I had once visited on Macaulay Lake on a particular Wednesday afternoon back in 1965. I'd forgotten all about it until its memory suddenly kick-started in all its strange detail. After a long flight from San Francisco had brought me to Barry's Bay for a short visit about 5 years after my father had died, I happened to be bombing up along Highway 60 in a rented car headed for the town dump. Unexpectedly, I was forced to slow down between Trout and Carson Lake, a few miles west of town. Jutting out from the roadside was a chartered bus with California license plates. It was flashing red hazard lights, it had Asian writing on its white side panels, and it was pulled over in front of the old entrance to the vacant campground at Carson Lake Provincial Park, its campsites largely overgrown and left derelict. From the Trout Lake side, a little old lady was trying to cross towards it, attempting to rejoin her touring entourage already seated in the bus, all waiting impatiently for her return. As I got closer, I saw she was in considerable distress, frantically waving her hands, standing alone on the wrong side of the road. She was wiping away tears from her eyes, unable to see clearly or cross safely. I pulled over, and as it turned out, she only spoke a few words of broken, heavily accented English, repeating them over and over again. So beautiful, so beautiful, so beautiful. I had no idea what she was going on about, until just before I got her back on the bus, She pointed excitedly towards a craggy, pine-covered outcropping of rock jutting into Trout Lake. It was then I understood perfectly. "Of course," I said, smiling at what had brought her to tears. It was a combination of late afternoon sun, brilliant blue sky, and a kaleidoscope of iridescent colors, all manifesting their magnificent, majestic autumn glory. It was enough to bring any old soul to tears, especially one who lived in California and had never seen a Madawaska Valley autumn. After she thanked me with a gentle embrace, and that white bus roared up towards Algonquin Park, I walked across the highway and out along that craggy old promontory. As a kid, I used to dive off its cliffs into the dark, soothing water 10 feet below. I remained there for the rest of that afternoon, soothing my world-weary bones, then in my early 60s, happily, I thought, in the moody remains of that miraculous autumn day, until I suddenly realized it was the first time I had played hooky there since leaving Barry's Bay back in the fall of 1973. All through the late 1950s, 60s, and early 70s, that little cliff was paradise, my most sacred place in all of Christendom, if only because it had once belonged to a 300-acre farm that my great-grandfather, Red Mick Conway, had homesteaded, beginning in the first year of Canadian Confederation. By the time I got to really know its ancestral dirt, Red Mick's grandson, Lorne Conway, my uncle, had inherited what was left. The provincial government had expropriated a goodly chunk back in the 1930s to make way for Highway 60 and that roadside park and Carson Lake Campground. Lorne had been born there in 1914 and grew up a quiet, gentle fellow, and as I was to find out, a very capable prankster who had never really left his childhood behind. He happily lived his entire life on that precious piece of Canadian shield until the early 70s, when unexpectedly he passed away peacefully, not yet 60 years of age, a committed bachelor who died with no last will and testament. As a result, the rest of that century-old farm passed away beyond Red Mick's family tree. In those glorious years, before that happened, I got to know Lorne. In September, he would take me, along with one of his rambunctious dogs he'd take in from friends and relatives who couldn't deal with difficult canine ways any longer, and we'd all bound up the hillside pasture overlooking Trout and Carson Lake. Along the way, he'd tell stories about local characters and their history connected to the farm, as we picked wild apples and fed them to his two old horses, Peggy and Tom. One year, after coming back from that pasture, he gave me a book he'd just finished reading and said he loved, and which I still cherish. It was Robert Murphy's very moving coming-of-age novel, The Pond. It's pure Lorne Conway. In October, I used to sit between Lorne and his youngest of seven brothers, my dad, and watch in naive amazement as they relived their own childhoods in front of that same farmhouse where Red Mick once slept. Lorne and my dad would talk on that sweeping front veranda, listening to the World Series, while my dad tried to bolster Lorne's courage to go down with him to the Trout Lake waterfront and help slaughter the annual prized pig. It was horrific work that Lorne hated, and so he would always try to get somebody else to do it. The sound of that squealing, stuck pig still haunts me as much as it gave some of my cousins nightmares. Yet for me, that sound became a tiny seed that would eventually grow into a very pragmatic love affair with autumn. Pragmatic because autumn, as I would eventually learn to accept it, was both a season to celebrate nature's bounty, at the same time as to prepare stoically for its coming death. Yet the uncle who taught me most about how to embrace the full majesty of autumn, truly, madly, deeply, that honor without a doubt belongs to my uncle MJ. Also born in 1914, his full name was Michael James Murray. He was my mother's older brother, and not unlike a proverbial black cat, MJ had more than just one life. If most locals knew Lorne Conway as a genial farmer and sometime bus driver for the Sherwood Public School in Barry's Bay, they knew M.J. Murray as the VP of Sales for Murray Brothers Lumber Company, a local firm founded by M.J.'s father and my grandfather, Tom Murray, and Tom's older brother, Mick. And as that VP of Sales, M.J. could always be counted on to underwrite any number of local baseball and hockey teams, if not countless hard luck stories. But for much of the 1960s and early 70s, I got to know something of MJ's other two lives, his passionate after-work love affair he had with fishing and hunting the local countryside. And during those outdoor expeditions, I would also get rare glimpses of that third, largely secret life that he kept mostly hidden and that dealt with his time overseas during the Second World War. It was that strange admixture of those two lives beyond MJ's day job where I really began to understand the true mystical qualities of our local autumn. I'd be the first to admit I never had the good sense to understand most of what I was seeing during those glorious autumns while Lorne and MJ were both still alive, if only because both generally refused to talk much about themselves. Both were masters of telling stories about other people, seemingly more interesting, if only to deflect from their own lives, especially MJ, who ultimately left me with the belief he had witnessed far too much soul-destroying combat in the Second World War. Early in the 1940s, MJ had trained as an RCAF flying officer, a navigator capable of directing Halifax, Whitley, and Stirling bombers. He left Barry's Bay for England in the summer of 1943 and spent two horrific years flying for RAF Bomber Command. He navigated by the stars and miraculously survived one too many night bombing raids up the Ruhr Express, flying all over Western Europe. In daylight, his bomber crew towed gliders full of paratroopers, or on moonless nights before D-Day, MJ would pinpoint drop zones for payloads of Sten guns and plastic explosives for the French resistance. Indeed, a story he never told me, or anyone else I'm aware of while he was still alive, involved one harrowing night raid shortly after D-Day, when he cheated death by frantically charting an emergency course for his badly shot-up Stirling bomber. Eventually, it ran out of fuel and crash-landed in a sheep pasture, where his entire crew somehow emerged from an early morning fog, safe in the English countryside, though that Stirling remains a smoldering, unredeemable wreck. When he finally made his way home to Barry's Bay in the autumn of 1945, he tucked his overused flight gear and German war mementos into his father's attic on Martin Street and dedicated his new life to reinventing himself as a very passionate, if distracting, bachelor outdoorsman. But he too died unexpectedly, not yet 62 years of age, and less than 4 years after Lorne. MJ rarely talked of his war, and usually, if pressed, only in ridiculously comedic terms, choosing to deflect questions with satiric lines he had picked up from his favorite TV show, Hogan's Heroes. Rather than respond to an inquisitive little boy, MJ would often repeat Sergeant Schultz's mantra he was forever voicing to remain silent whenever his incompetent commander, Colonel Klink, tried to corner him. "I know Nottings," MJ would say with mock imitation, before raising a round of distracting laughter among the rest of us, and so ending any attempt at finding out about his distinguished war record. Indeed, MJ Murray pursued a curious post-war life, attempting to forget, if not obliterate, that war record, all the while living an extraordinarily ordinary life in his father's house, where he'd been born and raised, and as luck would have it, where he lived right next door to his younger sister, my mother, who, as more luck would have it, had married Lorne Conway's youngest brother, my father, late in the 1940s. So it came as no real surprise to my parents when MJ, the bachelor, walked through my grandfather's back garden on any given day and asked to borrow a few of their 6-pint-sized sons, if only to take 2 or 3 of them fishing or hunting. Sometimes my father would join us if we were not, on rare occasions, traipsing off to Uncle Lorne's farm. My dad and Lorne both loved fishing, but certainly nobody ever loved it as obsessively as MJ. Basically, as kids, we were taken along for count, meaning that MJ expected that we'd hopefully never catch as many fish as himself. Still, in exchange for voluntarily enlisting in his fishing service, at the end of each and every expedition, MJ would serve us all up a belly-bursting feast of sugary treats purchased at Bernie and Mealy Coolis's corner store in Madawaska. No matter how few fish we might catch ourselves, and no matter what kind of wild shenanigans or misfortunes might have befallen us on any of MJ's generally rambunctious fishing and hunting expeditions, he could be counted on for those treats. Obviously, as children, we would have accepted those treats on most any terms, but we all soon discovered there was something else going on. It was also fair and reasonable compensation for providing MJ with game warden insurance. How so, you ask? Well, by having us along for the ride, MJ could assert to any overly suspicious Ontario Lands and Forest official that those 12 huge trout that lay flopping in the bottom of his fishing boat on Big Round Lake or Shirley Lake, well, they were all part of the legal limit allowed for qualified fishermen. 3 trout for each legal fishing rod, with 1 belonging to MJ and the other 3 belonging to his 3 pint-sized protégés, even though it was plain as the nose on the game warden's face that most, if not all, of those fish were caught by MJ himself. Still, my favorite time spent with Michael James Murray was not during those sugar-coated fishing trips where I always seemed to come up skunked but happily placated after suffering God knows how many mishaps, long marches, momentary losses of sanity, or, if absolutely necessary, clandestine maneuvers to outsmart Ontario's finest forest rangers. Rather, it was during MJ's fall hunting expeditions where I would eventually learn about the true meaning of autumn. His preferred vehicle for such adventures was his dusty old station wagon that he traded in every year or two, though most people deceived themselves into believing, because of its constantly shabby appearance, MJ never bought a new car. Year after year, that station wagon was carelessly camouflaged with a very thick layer of back road dirt and dust or winter slush, and so usually appeared as the same make, model, and color every year. Year after year, it also generally reeked of a few small disintegrating speckled trout that somehow had been forgotten and lay buried for months amidst his tangled heap of fishing gear, piled in careless mounds up against his dirty back window of that station wagon. Still, in particular, I remember well those magical Wednesday afternoons in the autumn of 1965 as an 11-year-old boy sitting in that station wagon when MJ played hooky from his sales job, and I had to attend school only in the mornings due to a chronic shortage of local schoolrooms. It was then MG would ask me to ride a long shotgun in his front passenger seat. Nowhere to be found on those Wednesday afternoons were my 3 older brothers, who were all still in school, and who would usually pull rank on me on those weekends when MG would take us all hunting. I would then be relegated to the back seat, given that I was the youngest during those greatest of boyhood adventures, MJ's annual autumn partridge hunt. He would load us all up in that dusty station wagon, along with his pristine double-barreled 12-gauge shotgun, tucking it neatly under the steering wheel along the gear shift beside him. He'd leave it slightly cracked open, just wide enough for 2 shells to be slipped into place as fast as grease lightning, and with both barrels snapped shut, on a moment's notice, he'd swiftly remove it as he quietly opened his door, of course after jamming on the brakes and stopping recklessly on a dime along some obscure patch of dirt far from civilization. With the deadly aim of that gun in hand, and in a matter of a few tense moments, charged with the possibility of imminent and catastrophic death, he'd then pull the trigger and usually hit bullseye on any fleeing bird 50 to 100 feet ahead, leaving a dying partridge gasping for air. That is, if his yappy little Conway lookouts had in fact managed to spot anything resembling a partridge. We thought our only job at that time during those awesome partridge hunts was to keep our eyes peeled for the prize, those giddy and goofy birds, as we all shot through ragged pine-topped hills and sunken hardwood valleys at death-defying speeds. In hindsight, MJ probably only wanted us along to enjoy the innocence of our own giddy and goofy ways, if not as an audience for his much more giddy and goofy imagination. Usually we'd head west from Barry's Bay towards Carson Lake, and after we passed Uncle Lorne's farm, we might bang a right to go flying down Arbor Vitae Road, or maybe just a little further west we'd scramble up along the ancient Opiongo Road, where MJ told us we could enjoy one of the last authentic stretches of that colonization road built in the 1850s. In fact, he would say, with his usual sardonic confidence, it's easy to see it was designed and built by a blind Indian and a drunken Scotsman, which we assumed was gospel, given that the Opiongo Road's undulating twists and hairpin turns gave our stomachs, forever dreaming of Bernie Coulis's ice cream and Mealy Coulis's soda pop, more than just a little dyspeptic fizz. Usually, during those weekend hunts, my lookout job involved standing on the back seat of his station wagon. This was long before seatbelts became mandatory. And though supposedly watching for partridges, more often than not, I'd see next to nothing before shots rang out. But on those Wednesday afternoons, when it was only MJ and myself riding shotgun, I'd get to hang my little buzz-cut blonde head out the passenger front window, and I'd watch as if some crazed, yappy little pup as partridge feathers exploded off the port side. Mind you, I'd rarely see a partridge before MJ himself spotted one, two, and sometimes even three at a time, given that I was easily distracted by intriguing things that might catch my interest. Things like the old log cabin on the old Opiongo Road built in 1864 by Richard Skuse. It was the first local post office in our area, and where MJ said my great-grandfather, Red Mick, probably got his mail. Sure as shooting. Regardless, even if I didn't spot a partridge in time for MG to take another shot, he could always be counted on to further distract me with any one of his 1,001 stories about those wild local characters he seemed to know personally, characters such as Dan McCauley, that drunken Scotsman. It was Mr. McCauley, MG would often tell me, who put all those damnable twists and god-awful turns into the Opiongo Road. No sober timber cruiser would ever have been counted on to botch up such a well-paying and easy government job and still end up with his dog breakfast we were now driving on. And as if to prove his point, we'd soon find ourselves taking a sharp left onto Spectacle Lake Road, where MG said it was the last authentic stretch of the Opiongo Road west of the Pecos. I knew Pecos meant Barry's Bay, just as I knew when he talked about Fagan's Town, he really meant Eganville. It was also MJ's contention that we could easily test for those authentic bits left over from the original Opiongo colonization road that once stretched more than 100 miles from Renfrew to Algonquin Park, but that had been largely straightened out, filled in, or paved over. Apparently, it was only authentic, according to MJ, if it turned and twisted and dipped and rose up again just enough to make a certain little boy throw up, especially if driven along at just the right pell-mell speed by a slightly mad fellow once capable of navigating a damaged bomber beyond a barrage of anti-aircraft flak. At such times, MJ could also be counted to break out into any number of short recitations. Suddenly, he'd frantically slam on the brakes and point towards something ahead that I could never see, no matter how hard I tried, and he'd keep pointing and then shout, "Dag nabbit, it's a rabbit! Get out and grab it!" Eventually, I'd stop laughing, and we'd cross out of Renfrew County into the district of Nipissing. Usually, that meant first bombing down the Opiongo River Valley, where we'd hunt along that bumpy stretch of washboard known as the Allen Lake Road. It was always a fun place, if only for its dusty side roads, and even if on those rare occasions no partridge could be found, as he'd say, come hell or high water, I'd still get my fill of those brilliant autumn colors, breaking through the rainbow canopy of multicolored leaves above, all dappling us with iridescent, flickering freckles that could easily distract any child worth distracting. Mercifully, the Allen Lake Road was not as badly built as the Opiongo Road. Obviously, MG would say, as it was a road neither surveyed nor designed, and certainly not built by Dan McCauley. Yet it did have two great advantages. The majestic Opiongo River ran right alongside, and opposite the road ran a lush hardwood bush that MG swore was a surefire habitat for those wily partridges, even smarter than Wile E. Coyote of Bugs Bunny fame. And so he would slow down for a genuine hawk-eyed look in hopes of spotting some well-camouflaged birds. Mind you, he'd just as often take his eyes off the road, and unexpectedly we were forced out of our seats as we bumped over the old OA and PS railroad crossing. Mercifully, he wouldn't speed up again until we spotted that curious old dilapidated water mill along the river and owned by Murray J. Daly. Strange, ghostly shambles of century-old clapboards, 3 stories high, and with its water wheel reaching more than halfway up, the whole place peeling red paint set against a rainbow of autumn colors. It seemed more an apparition waiting to be painted by some passing artist, like Tom Thompson, who MJ said used to paddle right past it. MJ would save the absolute best for last. After we passed outward bound through the village of Madawaska, before we'd stop homeward bound for treats, we'd bang another right and fly along Major Lake Road, only stopping momentarily at a wooden bridge traversing the Madawaska On one side, downriver, lay what MJ called the Big Blue Sea. On the other, about a mile or two upriver, lay a location that he said was a riffled section where rites of passage were carried out mid-autumn each year, someplace he called the Big Eddy. We then crossed that wooden bridge and traveled half a dozen more miles until we came to a fork in the road. Without hesitation, MG would bang a left onto the old Macaulay Lake Road, named not too surprisingly, he said, after that drunken Scotsman, Dan Macaulay himself. Wildly and with almost complete disregard for oncoming traffic, MG would drive like a bat out of hell to the very end of that road and the end of our partridge hunt on those Wednesday afternoons, usually burling up the dirt roadway like some supersonic jet trailing vaporized dust. He was hell-bent for a particular hunt camp at that far western end of Macaulay Lake, a place where his own uncle and father's partner, Mick Murray, often hid out during deer season with his fellow frontiersmen, all undoubtedly men and boys who knew everything there was to know about Dan Macaulay. But it was then, once we arrived there, that MJ's mood shifted. He'd turn off his engine, as if some Stirling after too long a bomb run, and quietly he'd take his 12-gauge and go inside that rickety old cabin, leaving me alone in the station wagon. He'd say he'd be a while, as he had to see Mick about some extra shotgun shells. Mick Murray died the year I was born, and so I never really expected to see MJ talking to anybody, at least not in the flesh, though sometimes I thought Mick's old ghost might poke its head out from behind that cabin screen door, welcoming his nephew. I never knew why exactly we had to stop there. We always carried enough shotgun shells with plenty of to spare. So I just thought of it as a place that haunted MJ somehow, a place he needed to go. It looked like it had no real caretaker, no real visitors, certainly no real hunters I ever saw, other than MJ alone, who strangely looked like he was on some sort of mission when he went inside, almost as if he was again barely my age back then, and somehow got left behind, as if, as a boy, trying to catch up to some hunting expedition that had gone off without him long before the war. So on that particular Wednesday, late that autumn afternoon in 1965, while MG was still inside Uncle Mick's cabin, I presume quietly kibbutzing with his old ghosts, I sat patiently outside, that is, until I couldn't. I remember having an overpowering urge to just open my front passenger door and go around to the driver's side and lean against it, sliding my back down its dusty panel just so I could look across the raised roadway narrowly bordering the beach. And so I did. I remember staring for the longest time across that western end of Macaulay Lake amidst a curious mix of pungent smells, fresh air gently blowing in off the lake, mixed with that putrid stink of dead fish and dead partridge, and that always seductive smell of black powder from spent shotgun shells. I soon lost all sense of time, being almost in a trance and continuing to stare across Macaulay Lake, until finally I saw with the eyes that only an 11-year-old boy can see with, a most remarkable southern shore. I knew it had once been the stomping ground of Dan Macaulay, who in truth I would find out much, much later had been a well-educated veteran of the American Civil War, and who had died at the other end of the Upyongo Road in Renfrew, a very long way from home. For some strange reason, though, back in the autumn of 1965, on that particular Wednesday, late in the afternoon, I felt as though Dan Macaulay were still there, watching me from across that black water, his head bowed as he was surveying a new road, but lifting it as though he had lost something valuable, looking confused, and then turning his head, having heard me slam the car door, or maybe MJ slam that old creaking screen door into the cabin. He was looking my way, just behind those shimmering, vibrant colors up along that far hillside, all ablaze with rich burgundies, blood reds, translucent yellows, and wild oranges, all set against parchment and bronze-like pigments, all gloriously disappearing from those trees in a matter of days, if not hours, all waiting for me to wave goodbye. Which is why, every Thanksgiving, I go up along that old Macaulay Lake Road, driving like a bat out of hell along its ancient dirt in my old dusty half-ton. And in lieu of never owning a 12-gauge, or never having killed a prized pig, I've been known to take a yappy young pup hanging its black wet nose out my front passenger window, as I once did out of MJ's dirty old station wagon. I stopped there on a dime at the end of that dirt road, hunting only for Mick Murray's old cabin, though I suspect it too has long disappeared before I could ever wave goodbye. Still, I stop in front of where I honestly believe I once was as an 11-year-old boy, overlooking those druidical black waters, and closing my eyes, I see MJ pass through that squeaky old screen door, leaving me to look across the lake one last time, before I well up with a feeling that would make even an old California Buddhist cry the moment she first lays eyes on that southern horizon and those miraculous autumns we have in the Madawaska and Apayongo River valleys. So beautiful. So beautiful. So beautiful.
Next up is a curious little memoir about a certain vacant lot at the corner of Inglis and Martin Streets in Barry's Bay, and specifically about some of the shenanigans that used to go on there in the 1960s. Curiously, after all these years, it still remains a vacant lot. And those of you who passed by there earlier this fall, well, it might look as though nothing much of significance would ever happen there. But you would be wrong, for those boys of autumn who were there 50 years ago will tell you it was not just any old vacant lot. It was the Back 40. Our next story takes us back out of town, this time westward, again near the hamlet of Madawaska, to two very specific places, namely the most mythical sections of two local rivers, the Madawaska and the Opiongo. Curiously, both places are called the Big Eddy. I know, local folk can be very confusing at times. I mean, who calls two different places with the same characteristics and so close together by the same name? It's worse than those two brothers, Daryl and his other brother, Daryl, from the old Bob Newhart TV show. Anyway, unlike the Back 40, there were things that went on locally in late October and early November after sundown on those two big eddies, and all for possibly illegal purposes. And wouldn't you know it? It was done not just with the Boys of Autumn helping out, but, can you believe it? It was done under adult supervision. And there you have it. Personal essays written and read exclusively for the Opiongo Line by Barry Conway, our producer. Mind you, I want to have a chat with Peter Cebulski about whether the boss really did bite him, or was he pulling our leg? I'm Kristen Marchand, and for our toothy producer, Barry Conway, we'd like to remind the ladies out there, we've heard just about enough from the boys and all their malarkey. Time to start telling us about the girls of summer, winter, spring, or fall, back in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. How else are we going to preserve and promote our full local heritage and culture if we only tell half the story? Good day, and God bless.